The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
This is where we ended last time. We had just talked about these major types of functions of neocortex. And I've named them according to how I think it evolved. Location sense, object sense, functions of the prefrontal elaborations of motor cortex for planning, and I'm going to go through that a little more. And that's basically what these questions are about. We had talked about the hippocampal system, and I want you to think about how that facilitates the ability to anticipate the stimuli that you're about to encounter, any animal's going to encounter. How does that location information that is handled by the hippocampus remember it? How it evolved? To know where the animal is in the local environment. And eventually in many different local environments, and we remember them. Our parietal cortex remembers them. So the hippocampus doesn't have to totally relearn it every time when you go to a different area. But because every time you turn your head, the way that system works, this information is sent from hippocampus back to the mammary bodies. That means the hippocampus is getting that information based on where, the direction we're looking. So it can call up all the relevant memories, the things in front of us. So it's a major factor in what, how the motivations make us decide to go in one direction or another, or in an animal. I shouldn't say humans primarily, but it's for navigating the world. And that we know that motivation is a major factor. And people haven't considered enough, you know, the role of the hippocampus in motivation. And why this whole system for memory, long-term memory, evolved within the hippocampus, within the limbic system, basically. But anyway, and you need to contrast that with the kind of anticipatory activity that these parietal and temporal association areas are concerned with. So we'll be talking more about that. So this is it's all in the book, and it's just a different way of looking at it in these slides where I summarize these major points. I think anticipation, ability to anticipate stimuli, ability to plan movements, another kind of anticipation, were major innovations of the cortex. It's not what the tectum does. It's not what subcortical systems do. This temporal aspect is so important for neocortex. And of course, planning, we know how important prefrontal areas are. They appear to evolve. Well, you could say that in that the original multimodal cortex, the motor cortex evolved very early. Initially a somatosensory, just as another somatosensory area. But once it became specialized for control of movement, then the areas near it became involved in anticipating movement, namely planning it. This is mostly theory, but I mention here support for it. The laboratory studies of Sokolov in Moscow back in the 60s, he did extensive studies of reactions of humans to novelty, and he studied animals as well. And how any kind of unexpected input, even if it was an unexpected lack of input, could cause an arousal response and alter the electrical activity of the neocortex. And when the inputs become familiar, then you don't get those arousal effects. So he in theoretical terms, he said that there was a central model. This is how the brain is simulating what's going on. When you're dreaming, all you're doing is using that system. Your brain is totally capable of simulating the environment in incredible detail. Have you ever had hypnagogic imagery or vivid dreaming where you actually don't know for sure that you're dreaming? You know, you see cartoons of people pinching themselves to see if they're asleep. Have you ever had such vivid dreams that you couldn't tell? Has everybody had them? Some people don't, or at least they don't remember, but I've had them, and they're really, not very many, and only when I was younger. Most of the time, I don't have difficulty knowing that I'm dreaming. Yeah, that's an anxiety dream, but in hypnagogic imagery, it's a good question. I don't know. We should look. There is a literature on it. You can read about it. And how do all the senses come to play? You know, I remember when I had them auditory, visual, somatosensory, they were all there. I cannot remember any olfactory imagery. I'm not saying it's not possible. Some people, but often it's true that some of the modalities are missing. And what you asked about emotion, that's a major issue, you know, in that kind of imagery. Because if it involves these association areas, the posterior cortex that generate these images of the world, posterior parietal primarily, the connections to emotion could be missing and it could still generate these images. So, if I have another one, I'll do the investigation. Anyway. So that same model can control endogenous generation of actions. This is the way the frontal areas and the posterior areas that do this kind of simulation of the world are connected. You can use that model to plan your actions, and we do it all the time. It's a view that became unpopular for a while, although back in the 60s, Don Mackay developed it. But more recently, people have come back to it, and they've updated it. There was a whole issue of I think the journal Cerebral Cortex, one of these major journals that talks about cortex, had a whole issue on this. I think I mentioned it in the book, if I'm remembering right. Okay, so now we've not mentioned striatum in this. Actually, both the striatum and the cortex expanded in evolution, including recent evolution. They can operate relatively independently, and that's because they don't operate independently in humans at all. But in animals, it's quite possible for them to operate independently. You can have an animal where much of the cortex is rendered non-functional, and he can still use his striatal system. Why is that? How is the striatum then getting its inputs? Where does it get its inputs if they don't come from the cortex? Remember, they come from the older parts of the thalamus. You know, the nuclei we call the intralaminar and midline nuclei, they're mostly getting multimodal input. But some of those nuclei are more dominated by the visual areas of the tectum. They're getting a lot of input from the optic tectum. The somatosensory system pathways don't all come through the tectum. Some of them come directly from the spinothalamic tract. And auditory inputs also reach those. And in addition to the intralaminar and midline nuclei, there are what appear to be older parts of the thalamus, in the posterior thalamus. There's a group of nuclei sort of in the interstices between the visual, somatosensory, and auditory, the main nuclei we consider to be involved in those three senses. But outside those nuclei, there's the posterior group of nuclei, and it's basically multimodal cells that project to multimodal cortical areas. Okay, well, we'll be talking more about that in a minute, but how did the cortex expand? We've talked about this before. It expanded by individual areas getting a lot bigger, like the striate area, especially the foveal area, got quite large, like here in the owl monkey. But it also, there's been a multiplication of different representations of the same sensory surface. So in this case, the retina, and it's represented in different ways. And sometimes we don't understand the functional differences. In some cases, we do understand. And that's an area that the functional imaging work in recent years has contributed quite a bit to for understanding this in the human brain. So what was probably the earliest parcellation of the pallium? Parcellation meaning it gets divided into different parts. How did the pallium get started? The whole embryo, initially, grew out of the olfactory system. It was totally dominated by olfaction. This view is actually a common one. It was argued by C. Judson Herrick, for example, in the early part of the 20th century. It was commonly believed, but the evidence for it wasn't major. They didn't know about some of the most primitive vertebrates. So he used the tiger salamander more than any other animal, and based a lot of his conclusions on what he found in the tiger salamander. He also, at that time, they didn't have the really good experimental tracing methods for looking at connections. But I have the big advantage now in writing about this stuff in that the techniques are much more sensitive, and they have been applied in a number of studies to some of these really primitive vertebrates. And that's why I talked in the olfactory, when we talked about olfactory system, I talked about the sea lampreys and the hagfish. Now, hagfish are more specialized, so some people don't think they're a very good model, but in both of those animals, olfactory projections go to everywhere in the embryo. Everywhere. In fact, they even go into the diencephalon directly from the olfactory bulbs. So the earliest parcellation is separation of the olfactory inputs from the non-olfactory. That's the earliest parcellation. So if you look at the gene expression data, you know, in the sea lamprey, it's been a little controversial with some varying results, but people that have reviewed it, that have gone over all of it and reviewed it carefully, will tell you that there's at least two main types according to gene expression, and it corresponds to the non-olfactory areas, non-olfactory and olfactory. Okay, so that was the earliest parcellation we know of in the pallium, and we know that that olfactory cortex doesn't get direct olfactory input from the olfactory bulbs, right? The olfactory bulbs project directly to it. But the part that the olfactory bulb doesn't project to, it's dominated by the thalamus. So then I ask about factors that influence thalamic parcellation. So we'll look at that. And then I mention what you commonly hear, and you'll probably hear it in medical schools if you take neuroanatomy, that these multimodal association areas are the most recent to evolve. I would change that a little bit and say no. They were probably the oldest type of cortex, but they're the most recent to really expand in the human brain. Because there's evidence that the unimodal areas are evolved out of that multimodal areas. If you look at the brains of some rodents that are a little more primitive in their structure, like the prairie voles have been studied, well studied for this, and look at the cortical unit recording work, you'll find that there's a lot of multimodal input into areas that we used to think were unimodal. They're multimodal. And even in the primary sensory areas, there's often more than one modality. You find other modalities going right into auditory cortex and visual cortex, for example. All of it supporting this view. Yeah. That is so loud in the back, I'm having trouble. There's a lot of incomplete parcellation. In fact, some of those mammals, you never find complete parcellation in the sensory areas. And that is just never taught. I don't know why it's not taught. Even Hubel and Wiesel here at Harvard doing that beautiful work on the visual cortex, they started with cats. They found some auditory inputs into the visual cortex of the cat. And you have to look very hard for it in their early papers. And I asked them about it one time, and they said, Torsten told me, yes, we did find that, and we didn't know what to do with it, so we sort of forgot about it. They were just working out how the cascade specification of unit properties in the visual system, because that wasn't known yet. So they focused on that, and sort of, the auditory input just wasn't important enough to understand the main things the visual cortex was doing. And I'm saying, well, if we're interested in evolution, though, we have to pay attention to these kinds of things. Oh, the synesthesia, okay. There's no evidence for that I know of. But now with good functional imaging methods, it would be possible to study synesthesia in a way that we couldn't before. You know, it's a good question. I will look into that because it's such an interesting question, you know. But I really doubt it's resulted in any major differences in the way the human brain is connected. So this is just what we're talking about. And the evidence I talk about, this is actually from data from hamsters that I studied, looking at projections from inferior colliculus, superficial and deep, superior colliculus, and from the pretectal area, and looking at where they go and the pattern they form in the thalamus. And if you look carefully at this, you see that in the thalamus you have the same spatial arrangement that you have this here. The auditory input comes in this more inferior lateral position, and that's where it forms its connections. But it's right next to multimodal parts of the lateral posterior nucleus, and then in the more superficial parts of the lateral posterior, getting inputs directly from the superior colliculus, it's visual. And up in front, you have the pretectal area, and those axons course rostrally near the midline, and they go right into the rostral parts of the lateral nucleus. highly neglected that pathway. And it's only recently that you can find studies of, you know, what it might be doing. So, because I worked in this area, I paid a lot of attention to that. I think when this picture was reproduced in the book, they put just L, but it's usually called the lateral dorsal nucleus. A few older papers will call it lateralis anterior. Okay, and then my interpretation of parcellation is that this shows input from the retina here in the dark blue, input from pretectum and inferior colliculus and superior colliculus coming into the thalamus, and how initially it's almost certain this big tectum sending projections into what initially was a pretty small diencephalon. They overlapped a lot. And if you look at the brain, like at the tiger salamander, you find these kind of widely branched axons in primitive animals. And in development, you still see a lot of that. But then, as they form connections, as the connections increase in density, they tended to then segregate from the other axons. And that's what I'm showing through these later stages. So here they're almost completely segregated. Inferior colliculus going down here. The retina going more superficially in the thalamus there to the ventral part. Superior colliculus carrying visual input information that did overlap with the geniculate body, in the geniculate body, but then it went to this, took over the parts of the LP. And then the pretectal, focusing on that, just specific sections of the LP. So you end up with this pattern. But that process where you get the segregation is called parcellation. Experimentally, if in development, if we got the retina to send projections to the wrong side of the tectum, here's what they do developmentally. They grow in and they just overlap with each other. They just intertwine. But then as they begin to form connections, the connections of one eye and the connections of the other eye segregate. Okay? As they get denser, they tend to terminate in the areas closest to where they came in. Because that's where they form denser connections first. You see, they got there first. That's where they form the connections first. And then they segregate. They pull away from each other. Literally. We don't think they don't necessarily degenerate the part that but it withdraws. Okay? All right. So the idea here is that multimodal convergence was the primitive state of most or all of the thalamus, and then parcellation occurred, and correlated changes occurred within the neocortex. I'm getting reports on a member of the family that's in the hospital. I can wait a few minutes to look at that. All right, so when you look across widely different animals, like here's the anamniotes. This is animals like the salamander, the frog. You know, they have fewer thalamic areas. When you go up to reptiles, there's more. Birds, even more, and mammals, the most. If you look in the human compared with other primates, you'll find the same areas, but you can subdivide the areas more. It's like the brain with evolution becomes more specialized. There's more parcellation than there is earlier. And that's what this comparative data support. This is just a concept slide based on one that Streeter published. And he, after reviewing a lot of this work, and then I talk about these three systems separately. These are all things that we did talk about when we talk about these systems, just to remind you. And then I talked about that segregation within the somatosensory system that led to the evolution of the motor cortex. And this is the picture that I had. This was from chapter 15. And it shows how you can define somatosensory cortex. You can define it in terms of thalamic projections, the part that gets input from the ventral posterior nucleus. Because that's where the somatosensory input comes in, from the spinal cord and the trigeminal system. And then anterior to that, the ventrolateral nucleus projects what we call motor cortex, the primary motor cortex. The VA anterior just goes even more anterior, premotor cortex. And it shows how these the projections of those two nuclei are completely overlapping in the virginal process. So if you record from it physiologically, you can't separate them. When you study the projections, you can't separate them. And then, this is not the opossum, it's the brush-tailed possum. It's a different animal. And you find an area that doesn't overlap for each of these nuclei, but then there's a fairly large area where they overlap. If you look at a rat, there's just an area of the hind limb representation where there has not been a complete parcellation. But otherwise, it's pretty segregated. If you look at a primate, like this is a galago, complete segregation. That's true of all the larger primates. In fact, I think all of the primates that I know about are like that. So the evidence is pretty good for this kind of parcellation in the somatosensory system and how the motor cortex evolved out of it. Okay, whereas for the visual system, people have looked at widely different animals, including marsupials. You always see a V1 and a V2. And in most of them, you see a third area that's always there, the area we call MT in the monkeys. And then you'll see varying numbers of the additional visual areas. And some, there are not many at all, not much cortex. But in the large primates and in humans, there is a very large number. So these are the methods of expansion that we talked about. These are pictures of that for the primates. And here you see in the gray color here, or the, maybe that's a bluish gray, you see what Meslin calls the heteromodal areas, the multimodal areas. And it's typical to picture rat and hedgehog, especially hedgehog. See how they picture it? No multimodal areas. I find that it'll be interesting to see how my colleagues that have published these kinds of pictures for a long time will react, because I've looked really carefully at that literature, and that is not what you find. There's a lot of multimodal cortex, and this is, so I have this slide. Multimodal regions do exist in between the major sensory areas in hedgehog, hamster, vole. It's been best studied in the vole. And unimodal and multimodal association areas are not so distinguishable as they are in primates, because they're all multimodal. At least two modalities will go into those areas. They might be dominated by one sense, but they're not really unimodal association areas. And then I talk about some multimodal inputs even in the primary sensory area. So, and that just indicates that this parcellation isn't complete. Maybe in the large primates, in humans, it's about as complete as it can be. But not in many animals. So it's a neglected fact that gives clues about evolution. And because of that, I paid a lot of attention to it. And then I have a little bit about axon trajectories that you should realize. That in, this is for reptilian cortex, but you see the same thing for amphibians and fishes, where in the cortex, the axons don't come in from below, like in this picture. You see here for the hedgehog, the mammal. They come in through the white matter, then they go up and terminate in the various layers, including layer one there. Whereas in the reptiles and turtles and in the salamander and other amphibians, they come in like this. They don't come in through a white matter. They travel tangentially. So if you look, this is the way that was pictured in Allman. He used a picture here of Pedro Ramon y Cajal's brother, Santiago Ramon y Cajal's brother, sorry. And this is from the American C.J. Herrick, where he shows a similar level, where you see this beautifully thick medial pallium with this cortex next to it. And it's a multimodal area of dorsal cortex. In most animals, it's called dorsal pallium or dorsal cortex. And it projects heavily into the medial pallium, but it gets multimodal input from the thalamus. But you see how the axons travel? Here they come out of the lateral forebrain bundle and they travel. They don't travel through a white matter at the base like the mammals. Okay, so then I point out that in the hamster, and this is true for hedgehog too, there are some neurons in lateral thalamus. Some of the data indicates they might all be in the posterior nuclear group, but they're in the lateral thalamus and they have a trajectory that's more like those primitive animals. So here's, I call it the type 1 axon, coming in like from geniculate body and arborizing primarily in layer 1 and 4. But they have some branches in the other layers as well. But then you have this other type that travel long distances and terminate. It's like they ignore the boundaries between cortical areas. They go even to the primary visual cortex, apparently carrying multimodal input. It's an anatomical It's an odd fact in neuroanatomy that such axons exist, and they've not been studied very well at all. Okay, but they can account for some of the physiological results that we've been talking about. Okay. So I want to talk more specifically now about, this is now stuff from chapter 33. Which we'll talk about next time as well. We'll try to finish chapter 33 next time and maybe at least get started in the last chapter in the book. So, I want to say more about cell types and their connections. Different regions, how we name them. There's different ways to talk about different regions. And then the major fiber roots, which we brought up before. But I want to review them. So, you should be able to contrast some of the major neuronal cell types. What are the two main cell types that you can think of? If you just think of structure, and talking about neocortex. When Nauta talked about these, he just mainly talked about these two cell types. The dominant cell type, pyramidal cells, with the apical dendrite going right up towards the surface and arborizing. Okay. And the other type, you can lump them all together and call them stellate cells. There are other shapes, fusiform shapes, for example, sort of a bipolar looking neuron. But there's other ways to classify them. You can use neurotransmitters. You can use whether they're spiny or non-spiny, whether they're excitatory or inhibitory. So the criteria vary. And the nicest classification I've seen is in this picture, which I put in the book, in which they separate these groups according to the spiny excitatory neurons, all using glutamate as a transmitter, the non-spiny inhibitory, or GABAergic interneurons. And notice that these are most all stellate in shape. A few of them might have a fusiform shape, and mostly these star-shaped cells that don't have an apical dendrite. Here are the pyramidal cells with this apical dendrite. And this, you see here, this is one in layer 5. It's a big pyramidal cell. The apical dendrite goes right up and arborizes in layer 1. And usually these pictures lack a lot of the processes that are really there. They're pretty complex. And it shows an enlargement here. If you look at higher magnification of a Golgi stain or a cell that's been filled with HRP or something like that, you see the little spines they can take. So that's, and the spines are sites of many of the synapses are formed in the spines. And then it shows where they go. Like these big cells in layer 5 go to the spinal cord, brainstem, thalamus, striatum, and other areas of cortex. Okay? The pyramidal cells in layer 3 and layer 2 are much smaller, but they're still pyramidal in shape. They're transcortical. So they're association cells of the cortex. You know, the proprio-cortical cells, a term that's not usually used, but it's an appropriate term. And the only excitatory cell here that's not pyramidal in shape is a little stellate cell. We often call them granule cells in layer 4. They get a lot of input from the thalamus comes in there, and the axon simply terminates within the same column, carries that information right up to the superficial layers, which we often call association layers, layers 2 and 3, because they contain these neurons. They're getting input from these stellates in layer 4, and they're projecting to other areas of cortex. Now, they do get other inputs. They get some direct input from the thalamus, too, because the thalamus contacts those branches of the pyramidal cell. And then you'll see here for the non-spiny inhibitory interneurons how many different shapes. And look at the way the axons form. You know, you see cells like this that have an axon that distributes all the nearby columns. Here's one that is all the axon distributes up and down the same column. Okay? But they've all got local axons. Some of them covering a number of columns, some of them covering only one column. But so two major divisions according to this classification. But if you do it just structurally, you would say pyramidal and stellate are the two major types. And that's what here's from Nauta's book. He shows a small pyramidal cell in layer 6, and then he shows a couple of stellates. And he has a more elaborate picture of their, both the dendrites and the axons. Whereas other anatomy books like Brodahl has a simplified picture of, in this case, interneurons, where he's showing some of those same cells that are in the other picture, but he's put the axons in red like they did, simplified the dendritic tree a little bit, and indicates how they terminate. These are all GABAergic cells. Except this one. This is probably an excitatory cell, therefore. So this would be the only one that is classified over here because it's a spiny excitatory cell. Alright. Then I point out here that not all local interconnections within the neocortex are made by the short axon interneurons. And I'm talking about just locally, but in the same column or between one column and nearby columns. They're made by axon collaterals. Almost all pictures of this that you see in textbooks never show this elaborate collateralization of the axon, but the Scheibels were very good anatomists. They published some of the best Golgi pictures in modern anatomical literature. And this, here they're showing that the dendritic spread of, in the cat, of neocortical cells averaged around 500 microns. Whereas the axon collaterals of the initial segment of the axon, in this case the axons are all going out, this one to other cortical areas, these two out to the thalamus and brainstem and spinal cord. Look how much they cover. 3,000 microns, so 3 millimeters. So huge numbers of local connections are formed by these axon collaterals. Okay, now you should be able to answer this. How have neuroscientists defined cortical layers and cortical columns? Divide it into anatomical methods, with the Nissl method and also the Golgi method, if it's sort of dominated, also fiber stains. But what about the functional side? Electrophysiology. Our initial definition of columns came from electrophysiologists putting microelectrodes and seeing functional differences between one region of cortex and immediately adjacent. Like in the visual cortex, you'd find that cells here respond to one eye, cells here respond to the next eye, then back to the first eye, then the second, and so forth. You know? So, physiological methods and various anatomical methods. There are molecular methods in addition that have been applied, especially for layers. If you look back in chapter 2, I had a picture where they had antibodies that bound to cells in specific laminae, specific layers of the neocortex. So that's still one more method. Molecular methods used for neuroanatomy. And this just summarizes these pictures. This is the one I used in the book. And this is the one that usually you see in books. And people will wonder, why did I choose this one by an American neuroanatomist, and not the one that's always published? And that's because I insisted, with Amy's help, finding the sources. I didn't want it. If I found people cited a certain source, I found the source. And I found out it was wrong. Again and again and again. Because people usually aren't that careful in their scholarship. I just wanted to point that out to you. You can't believe everything you read. Even in science. Okay, especially scientists aren't always very good historians. Just thought you might like to know that. And we'll have to stop there. We'll come back and go through a few of these things. Focus on the pictures. Make sure you're understanding the pictures, okay? They're all posted. It talks about cortical types, cortical columns, how you can define them anatomically, layers as well, and a few of the things that are commonly stated. Okay, so we'll come back there. In the next class. And I know we can get through these, and I hopefully we can get a little bit into the next chapter as well.